The pipe music rose to a fervent pitch and then abruptly ceased. In the dead silence of the hall, Colm McKenzie stepped out from the upper archway and strode purposefully to a small platform that had been erected at the head of the room. If he made no effort to hide his disability, he did not flaunt it now either. He was splendid in an azure blue coat, heavily laced with gold, buttoned with silver, and with rose silk cuffs that turned back almost to the elbow. A tartan kilt in fine wool hung past his knees, covering most of his legs and the checked stockings on them. His bonnet was blue, but the silver badge held plumes, not holly. The entire hall held its breath as he took centre stage. Whatever else he was, Colm McKenzie was a showman. He turned to face the assembled clansmen, raised his arms, and greeted them with a ringing shout. "Tulachard! Tulachard!" the clansman gave back in a roar. The woman next to me shivered. There was a short speech next, given in Gaelic. This was greeted with periodic roars of approval, and then the oath-taking proper commenced. Dougal McKenzie was the first man to advance to Colm's platform. The small rostrum gave Colm enough height that the brothers met face to face. Dougal was richly dressed, but in plain chestnut velvet with no gold lace, so as not to distract attention from Colm's magnificence. Dougal drew his dirk with a flourish and sank to one knee, holding the dirk upright by the blade. His voice was less powerful than Colm's, but loud enough so that every word rang through the hall. "I swear by the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ and by the holy iron that I hold to give ye my fealty and pledge ye my loyalty to the name of the Clan Mackenzie. If ever my hand shall be raised against ye in rebellion, I ask that this holy iron shall pierce my heart." He lowered the dirk, kissed it at the juncture of haft and tang, and thrust it home in its sheath. Still kneeling, he offered both hands clasped to Colm, who took them between his own and lifted them to his lips in acceptance of the oath so offered. Then he raised Dougal to his feet. Turning, Colm picked up a silver quaigh from its place on the tartan-covered table behind him. He lifted the heavy-eared cup with both hands, drank from it, and offered it to Dougal. Dougal took a healthy swallow and handed back the cup. Then, with a final bow to the laird of the Clan Mackenzie, he stepped to one side to make room for the next man in line. This same process was repeated over and over from vow to ceremonial drink. Viewing the number of men in the line, I was impressed anew at Colm's capacity. I was trying to work out how many pints of spirit he would have consumed by the end of the evening, given one swallow per oath-taker, when I saw Jamie approach the head of the line. Dougal, his own oath completed, had taken up a station to Colm's rear. He saw Jamie before Colm, who was occupied with another man, and I saw his sudden start of surprise. He stepped close to his brother and muttered something. Colm kept his eyes fixed on the man before him, but I saw him stiffen slightly. He was surprised too, and, I thought, not altogether pleased. The level of feeling in the hall, high to start with, had risen through the ceremony. If Jamie were to refuse his oath at this point, I thought he could easily be torn to shreds by the overwrought clansmen around him. I wiped my palm surreptitiously against my skirt, feeling guilty at having brought him into such a precarious situation. He seemed composed. Hot as the hall was, he wasn't sweating. He waited patiently in line, showing no signs of realizing that he was surrounded by 100 men, armed to the teeth, who would be quick to resent any insult offered to the Mackenzie and the clan. Je suis prêt, indeed. Or perhaps he had decided, after all, to take Alec's advice. My nails were digging into my palms by the time it came his turn. He went gracefully to one knee and bowed deeply before Colm. But instead of drawing his knife for the oath, he rose to his feet and looked Colm in the face. Fully erect, he stood head and shoulders over most of the men in the hall, and he topped Colm on his rostrum by several inches. I glanced at the girl, Leah. She had gone pale when he rose to his feet, and I saw that she also had her fists clenched tight. Every eye in the hall was on him, but he spoke as though to Colum alone. His voice was as deep as Colum's, and every word was clearly audible. "Colum Mackenzie, I come to you as kinsman and as ally. I give ye no vow, for my oath is pledged to the name that I bear." There was a low, ominous growl from the crowd, but he ignored it and went on. "But I give you freely the things that I have, my help and my goodwill, wherever you should find need of them. I give ye my obedience, as kinsman and as laird, and I hold myself bound by your word, so long as my feet rest on the lands of Clan Mackenzie." He stopped speaking and stood, tall and erect, hands relaxed at his sides. "Ball now in Colum's court," I thought. "One word from him, one sign, and they'd be scrubbing the young man's blood off the flags come morning." Colum stood unmoving for a moment, then smiled and held out his hands. After an instant's hesitation, Jamie placed his own hands lightly on Colum's palms. "We are honoured by your offer of friendship and goodwill," said Colum clearly. "We accept your obedience and hold you in good faith as an ally of the Clan Mackenzie." There was a lessening of the tension over the hall, and almost an audible sigh of relief in the gallery as Colum drank from the quech and offered it to Jamie. The young man accepted it with a smile. Instead of the customary ceremonial sip, however, he carefully raised the nearly full vessel, tilted it, and drank. And kept on drinking. There was a gasp of mingled respect and amusement from the spectators as the powerful throat muscles kept moving. Surely he'd have to breathe soon, I thought. But no. He drained the heavy cup to the last drop, lowered it with an explosive gasp for air, and handed it back to Colum. "The honour is mine," he said, a little hoarsely, "to be allied with a clan whose taste in whisky is so fine." There was an uproar at this, and he made his way toward the archway, much impeded by congratulatory handshakes and thumps on the back as he passed. Apparently Colum Mackenzie was not the only member of the family with a knack for good theatre. The heat in the gallery was stifling, and the rising smoke was making my head ache before the oath-taking finally came to an end, with what I assumed were a few stirring words by Colum. Unaffected by six shared quaffs of spirit, the strong voice still reverberated off the stones of the hall. At least his legs wouldn't pain him tonight, I thought, in spite of all the standing. There was a massive shout from the floor below, an outbreak of skirling pipes, and the solemn scene dissolved into a heaving surge of riotous yelling. An even louder shout greeted the tubs of ale and whiskey that now appeared on trestles, accompanied by platters of steaming oatcakes, haggis, and meat. Mrs. Fitz, who must have organised this part of the proceedings, leaned precariously across the balustrade, keeping a sharp eye on the behaviour of the stewards, mostly lads too young to swear a formal oath. "And where's the pheasants got to, then?" she muttered under her breath, surveying the incoming platters. "Or the stuffed eels, either. Drat that Mungo Grant! I'll skin him if he's burnt the eels." Making up her mind, she turned and began to squeeze toward the back of the gallery, plainly unwilling to leave administration of something so critical as the feasting in the untried hands of Mungo Grant. Seizing the opportunity, I pushed along behind her, taking advantage of the sizable wake she left through the crowd. Others, clearly thankful for a reason to leave, joined me in the exodus. Mrs. Fitz, turning at the bottom, saw the flock of women above and scowled ferociously. "You wee lasses, clear off to your rooms right sharp," she commanded. "If you'll not stay up there safe out of sight, you'd best scamper awa' to your own places. But no lingering in the corridors, nor peeping round the corners. There's not a man in the place who's not half in his cups already, and they'll be far gone in an hour. 'Tis no place for lasses tonight." Pushing the door ajar, she peered cautiously into the corridor. The coast, apparently clear, she shooed the women out the door, one at a time, sending them hurriedly on their way to their sleeping quarters on the upper floors. "Do you need any help?" I asked as I came even with her. "In the kitchens, I mean." She shook her head, but smiled at the offer.
"Nay, there's no need, lass. Get along with you now. You're no safer than the rest."
And a kindly shove in the small of the back sent me hurtling out into the dim passage. I was inclined to take her advice after the encounter with the guard outside. The men in the hall were rioting, dancing, and drinking, with no thought of restraint or control. No place for a woman, I agreed. Finding my way back to my room was another matter altogether. I was in an unfamiliar part of the castle, and while I knew the next floor had a breezeway that connected it to the corridor leading to my room, I couldn't find anything resembling stairs. I came around a corner and smack into a group of clansmen. These were men I didn't know, come from the outlying clan lands and unused to the genteel manners of a castle. Or so I deduced from the fact that one man, apparently in search of the latrines, gave it up, and chose to relieve himself in a corner of the hallway as I came upon them. I whirled at once, intending to go back the way I had come, stairs or no stairs. Several hands reached to stop me, though, and I found myself pressed against the wall of the corridor, surrounded by bearded Highlanders with whiskey on their breath and rape on their minds. Seeing no point in preliminaries, the man in front of me grabbed me by the waist and plunged his other hand into my bodice. He leaned close, rubbing his bearded cheek against my ear.
"And how about a sweet kiss now for the brave lads of the Clan Mackenzie, to the heart?"
"Erin go brah," I said rudely, and pushed with all my strength. Unsteady with drink, he staggered backward into one of his companions. I dodged to the side and fled, kicking off my clumsy shoes as I ran. Another shape loomed in front of me, and I hesitated. There seemed to be only one in front of me, though, and at least 10 behind me, catching up fast despite their cargo of drink. I raced forward, intending to dodge around him. He stepped sharply in front of me, though, and I came to a halt so fast that I had to put my hands on his chest to avoid crashing into him. It was Dougal Mackenzie.
"What in hell?" he began,
then saw the men after me. He pulled me behind him and barked something at my pursuers in Gaelic. They protested in the same language, but after a short exchange, like the snarling of wolves, they gave it up and went off in search of better entertainment. "Thank you," I said, a little dazed. "Thank you. I'll go. I shouldn't be down here." Dougal glanced down at me and took my arm, pulling me around to face him. He was dishevelled, and clearly had been joining in the roistering in the hall.
"True enough, lass," he said. "You shouldn't be here. Since you are, well, you'll have to pay the penalty for that," he murmured, eyes gleaming in the half-dark.
And without warning, he pulled me hard against him and kissed me. Kissed me hard enough to bruise my lips and force them apart. His tongue flicked against mine, the taste of whiskey sharp in my mouth. His hands gripped me firmly by the bottom and pressed me against him, making me feel the rigid hardness under his kilt through my layers of skirts and petticoats. He released me as suddenly as he had seized me. He nodded and gestured down the hall, breathing a little unsteadily. A lock of russet hair hung loose over his forehead, and he brushed it back with one hand.
"Get ye gone, lassie," he said, "before ye pay a greater price."
I went, barefoot. Given the carryings-on of the night before, I had expected most inhabitants of the castle to lie late the next morning, possibly staggering down for a restorative mug of ale when the sun was high, assuming that it chose to come out at all, of course. But the Highland Scots of Clan Mackenzie were a tougher bunch than I had reckoned with, for the castle was a buzzing hive long before dawn, with rowdy voices calling up and down the corridors, and a great clanking of armoury and thudding of boots as men prepared for the tinchel. It was cold and foggy, but Rupert, whom I met in the courtyard on my way to the hall, assured me that this was the best sort of weather in which to hunt boar.
"The beasts is such a thick coat, the cold's no hindrance to them," he explained, sharpening a spear point with enthusiasm against a foot-driven grindstone. "And they feel safe with the mist so heavy all around them. Canna see the men coming toward them, you ken."
I forbore to point out that this meant the hunting men wouldn't be able to see the boar they were approaching either, until they were upon it. As the sun began to streak the mist with blood and gold, the hunting party assembled in the forecourt, spangled with damp and bright-eyed with anticipation. I was glad to see that the women were not expected to participate, but contented themselves with offering bannocks and draughts of ale to the departing heroes. Seeing the large number of men who set out for the East Wood, armed to the teeth with boar spears, axes, bows, quivers and daggers, I felt a bit sorry for the boar. This attitude was revised to one of awed respect an hour later, when I was hastily summoned to the forest's edge to dress the wounds of a man who had, as I surmised, stumbled over the beast unawares in the fog. "Bloody Christ," I said, examining a gaping, jagged wound that ran from knee to ankle. "An animal did this? What's it got, stainless steel teeth?" "Eh?" The victim was white with shock and too shaken to answer me, but one of the fellows who had assisted him from the wood gave me a curious look. "Never mind," I said, and yanked tight the compression bandage I had wound about the injured calf. "Take him up to the castle and we'll have Mrs. Fitz give him hot broth and blankets. That'll have to be stitched, and I've no tools for it here." The rhythmic shouts of the same beaters still echoed in the mists of the hillside. Suddenly there was a piercing scream that rose high above fog and tree, and a startled pheasant broke from its hiding place nearby with a frightening rattle of wings. "Dear God in heaven, what now?" Seizing an armful of bandages, I abandoned my patient to his caretakers and headed into the forest at a dead run. The fog was thicker under the branches, and I could see no more than a few feet ahead, but the sound of excited shouting and thrashing underbrush guided me in the right direction. It brushed past me from behind. Intent on the shouting, I didn't hear it, and I didn't see it until it had passed. A dark mass moving at incredible speed, the absurdly tiny cloven hooves almost silent on the sodden leaves. I was so stunned by the suddenness of the apparition that it didn't occur to me at first to be frightened. I simply stared into the mist where the bristling black thing had vanished. Then, raising my hand to brush back the ringlets that were curling damply around my face, I saw the blotched red streak across it. Looking down, I found a matching streak on my skirt. The beast was wounded. Had the scream come from the boar, perhaps? I thought not. I knew the sound of mortal wounding. And the pig was moving well under its own power when it had passed me. I took a deep breath and went on into the wall of mist in search of a wounded man. I found him at the bottom of a small slope, surrounded by kilted men. They had spread their plaids over him to keep him warm, but the cloth covering his legs was ominously dark with wetness. A wide scrape of black mud showed where he had tumbled down the length of the slope, and a scrabble of mud-dried leaves and churned earth where he had met the boar. I sank to my knees beside the man, pulled back the cloth, and set to work. I had scarcely begun when the shouts of the men around us made me turn to see the nightmare shape appear once more, soundless, out of the trees. This time I had time to see the dagger hilt protruding from the beast's side, perhaps the work of the man on the ground before me, and the wicked yellow ivory, stained red as the mad little eyes. The men around me, as stunned as I was, began to stir and reach for weapons. Faster than the rest, a tall man seized a boar spear from the hands of a companion who stood frozen and stepped out into the clearing. It was Dougal Mackenzie. He walked almost casually, carrying the spear low, braced in both hands, as though about to lift a spadeful of dirt. He was intent on the beast, speaking to it in an undertone, murmuring in Gaelic, as though to coax the beast from the shelter of the tree it stood beside. The first charge was sudden as an explosion. The beast shot past so closely that the brown hunting tartan flapped in the breeze of its passing. It spun at once and came back, a blur of muscular rage. Dougal leapt aside like a bullfighter, jabbing at it with his spear. Back, forth, and again. It was less a rampage than a dance, both adversaries rooted in strength, but so nimble they seemed to float above the ground. The whole thing lasted only a minute or so, though it seemed much longer. It ended when Dougal, whirling aside from the slashing tusks, raised the point of the short, stout spear and drove it straight down between the beast's sloping shoulders. There was the thunk of the spear and a shrill squealing noise that made the hairs stand up along my forearms. The small, piggy eyes cast to and fro, veering wildly in search of Nemesis, and the dainty hooves sank deep in mud as the boar staggered and lurched. The squealing went on, rising to an inhuman pitch as the heavy body toppled to one side, driving the protruding dagger hilt-deep in the hairy flesh. The delicate hooves spurned the ground, churning up thick clods of damp earth. The squeal stopped abruptly. There was silence for a moment, and then a thoroughly piggish grunt, and the bulk was still. Dougal hadn't waited to make sure of the kill, but had circled the twitching animal and made his way back to the injured man. He sank to his knees and put an arm behind the victim's shoulders, taking the place of the man who had been supporting him. A fine spray of blood had spattered the high cheekbones, and drying droplets matted his hair on one side. "Now then, Geordie," he said, rough voice suddenly gentle. "Now then. I've got him, man. It's all right." "Dougal, is it you, man?" The wounded man turned his head in Dougal's direction, struggling to open his eyes. I was surprised, listening as I rapidly checked the man's pulse and vital signs. Dougal the fierce, Dougal the ruthless, was speaking to the man in a low voice, repeating words of comfort, hugging the man hard against him, stroking the tumbled hair. I sat back on my heels and reached again toward the pile of cloths on the ground beside me. There was a deep wound, running at least 8 inches from the groin down the length of the thigh, from which the blood was gushing in a steady flow. It wasn't spurting, though. The femoral artery wasn't cut, which meant there was a good chance of stopping it. What couldn't be stopped was the ooze from the man's belly, where the ripping tushes had laid open skin, muscles, mesentery, and gut alike. There were no large vessels severed there, but the intestine was punctured. I could see it plainly through the jagged rent in the man's skin. This sort of abdominal wound was frequently fatal, even with a modern operating room, sutures and antibiotics readily to hand. The contents of the ruptured gut, spilling out into the body cavity, simply contaminated the whole area and made infection a deadly certainty. And here, with nothing but cloves of garlic and yarrow flowers to treat it with. My gaze met Dougal's as he also looked down at the hideous wound. His lips moved, mouthing soundlessly over the man's head the words, "Can he live?" I shook my head mutely. He paused for a moment, holding Geordie, then reached forward and deliberately untied the emergency tourniquet I had placed around the man's thigh. He looked at me, challenging me to protest, but I made no move save a small nod. I could staunch the bleeding and allow the man to be transported by litter back to the castle. Back to the castle, there to linger in increasing agony as the belly wound festered, until the corruption spread far enough finally to kill him, wallowing perhaps for days in long, drawn-out pain. A better death, perhaps, was what Dougal was giving him, to die cleanly under the sky, his heart's blood staining the same leaves, dyed by the blood of the beast that killed him. I crawled over the damp leaves to Geordie's head and took half his weight on my own arm. "It will be better soon," I said. And my voice was steady, as it always was, as it had been trained to be. "The pain will be better soon." "Aye, it's better,"
now. I can't feel my leg any more, nor my hands. Dougal, are you there? Are you there, man?
The numb hands were blindly flailing before the man's face. Dougal grasped them firmly between his own and leaned close, murmuring in the man's ear.
Geordie's back arched suddenly, and his heels dug deeply into the muddy ground, his body in violent protest at what his mind had begun already to accept. He gasped deeply from time to time, as a man who is bleeding to death gulps for air, hungry for the oxygen that his body is starving for. The forest was very quiet. No birds sang in the mist, and the men, who waited patiently hunkered in the shadow of the trees, were silent as the trees themselves. Dougal and I leaned close together over the struggling body, murmuring and comforting, sharing the messy, heart-rending and necessary task of helping a man to die. The trip up the hill to the castle was silent. I walked beside the dead man, borne on a makeshift litter of pine boughs. Behind us, borne in precisely similar fashion, came the body of his foe. Dougal walked ahead, alone. As we entered the gate to the main courtyard, I caught sight of the tubby little figure of Father Bain, the village priest, hurrying belatedly to the aid of his fallen parishioner. Dougal paused, reached out to stay me as I turned toward the stair leading to the surgery. The bearers, with Geordie's plaid-shrouded body on its litter, passed on, heading toward the chapel, leaving us together in the deserted corridor. Dougal held me by the wrist, looking me over intently.
"You've seen men die before," he said flatly. "By violence."
Not a question, almost an accusation.
"Many of them," I said, just as flatly.
And pulling myself free, I left him standing there and went to tend my living patient. The death of Geordie, hideous as it was, put only a momentary damper on the celebrations. A lavish funeral mass was said over him that afternoon in the castle chapel, and the games began the next morning. I saw little of them, being occupied in patching up the participants. All I could say for sure of authentic Highland games is that they were played for keeps. I bound up some fumblefoot who had managed to slash himself trying to dance between swords. I set the broken leg of a hapless victim who'd got in the way of a carelessly thrown hammer, and I doled out castor oil and nasturtium syrup to countless children who had overindulged in sweeties. By late afternoon I was near exhaustion. I climbed up on the surgery table in order to poke my head out of the tiny window for some air. The shouts and laughter and music from the field where the games were held had ceased. Good. No more new patients then, at least not until tomorrow. What had Rupert said they were going to do next? Archery? I checked the supply of bandages and wearily closed the surgery door behind me. Leaving the castle, I trailed downhill toward the stables. I could do with some good non-human, non-speaking, non-bleeding company. I also had in mind that I might find Jamie, whatever his last name was, and try again to apologize for involving him in the oath-taking. True, he had brought it off well, but clearly he wouldn't have been there at all, left to his own devices. As to the gossip Rupert might now be spreading about our supposed amorous dalliance, I preferred not to think. As to my own predicament, I preferred not to think about that either, but I would have to sooner or later. Having so spectacularly failed to escape at the beginning of the gathering, I wondered whether the chances might be better at the end. True, most of the horses would be leaving, along with the visitors, but there would be a number of castle horses still available, and with luck, the disappearance of one would be put down to random thievery. There were plenty of villainous-looking scoundrels hanging about the fairground and the games, and in the confusion of leaving, it might be some time before anyone discovered that I was gone. I scuffed along the paddock fence, pondering escape routes.
The difficulty was that I had only the vaguest idea where I was with reference to where I wanted to go. And since I was now known to virtually every Mackenzie between Leoch and the border, thanks to my doctoring at the games, I wouldn't be able to ask directions. I wondered suddenly whether Jamie had told Colm or Dougal of my abortive attempt to escape on the night of the oath-taking. Neither of them had mentioned it to me, so perhaps not. There were no horses out in the paddock. I pushed open the stable door, and my heart skipped a beat to see both Jamie and Dougal seated side by side on a bale of hay. They looked almost as startled at my appearance as I was at theirs, but gallantly rose and invited me to sit down. "That's all right," I said, backing toward the door. "I didn't mean to intrude on your conversation."
"Nay, lass," said Dougal. "What I've just been saying to young Jamie here concerns you too."
I cast a quick look at Jamie, who responded with a trace of a headshake. So he hadn't told Dougal about my attempted escape. I sat down, a bit wary of Dougal. I remembered that little scene in the corridor on the night of the oath-taking, though he hadn't referred to it since by word or gesture.
"I'm leaving in 2 days' time," he said abruptly, "and I'm taking the two of you with me."
"Taking us where?" I asked, startled. My heart began to beat faster.
"Through the Mackenzie lands. Colm doesn't travel, so visiting the tenants and taxmen that canna come to the gathering, that's left to me, and to take care of the bits of business here and there."
He waved a hand, dismissing these as trivial. "But why me? Why us, I mean?" I demanded. He considered for a moment before answering.
"Why, Jamie's a handy lad with the horses. And as to you, lass, Colm thought it wise I should take ye along as far as Fort William. The commander there might be able to assist ye in finding your family in France."
"Or to assist you," I thought, "in determining who I really am. And how much else are you not telling me?" Dougal stared down at me, obviously wondering how I would take this news. "All right," I said tranquilly. "That sounds a good idea." Outwardly tranquil, inwardly I was rejoicing. What luck! Now I wouldn't have to try to escape from the castle. Dougal would take me most of the way himself. And from Fort William, I thought I could find my own way without much difficulty. To Craig na Dun, to the Circle of Standing Stones, and with luck, back home. Part 3. On the Road. Chapter 11. Conversations with a Lawyer. We rode out of the gates of Castle Leoch 2 days later, just before dawn. In twos and threes and fours, to the sound of shouted farewells and the calls of wild geese on the loch, the horses stepped their way carefully over the stone bridge. I glanced behind from time to time until the bulk of the castle disappeared at last behind a curtain of shimmering mist. The thought that I would never again see that grim pile of stone or its inhabitants gave me an odd feeling of regret. The noise of the horses' hooves seemed muffled in the fog. Voices carried strangely through the damp air, so that calls from one end of the long string were sometimes heard easily at the other, while the sounds of nearby conversation were lost in broken murmurs. It was like riding through a vapour peopled by ghosts. Disembodied voices floated in the air, speaking far away, then remarkably near at hand. My place fell in the middle of the party, flanked on the one side by a man-at-arms whose name I didn't know, and on the other by Ned Gowan, the little scribe I had seen at work in Collins Hall. He was something more than a scribe, I found, as we fell into conversation on the road. Ned Gowan was a solicitor, born, bred, and educated in Edinburgh. He looked the part thoroughly. A small, elderly man of neat, precise habits, he wore a coat of fine broadcloth, fine woollen hose, a linen shirt whose stock bore the merest suggestion of lace, and breeches of a fabric that was a nicely judged compromise between the rigours of travel and the status of his calling. A small pair of gold-rimmed half-spectacles, a neat hair ribbon, and a bicorn of blue felt completed the picture. He was so perfectly the quintessential man of law that I couldn't look at him without smiling. He rode alongside me on a quiet mare, whose saddle was burdened with two enormous bags of worn leather. He explained that one held the tools of his trade, inkhorn, quills, and papers. "And what's the other for?" I asked, eyeing it. While the first bag was plump with its contents, the second seemed nearly empty.
"Oh, that's for his lairdship's rents,"
the lawyer replied, patting the limp bag.
"He must be expecting rather a lot, then," I suggested. Mr. Gowan shrugged good-naturedly. "Not so much as all that, my dear. But the most of it will be in doits and pence and other small coins. And such, unfortunately, take up more room than the larger denominations of currency."
He smiled, a quick curve of thin, dry lips.
"At that, a weighty mass of copper and silver is still easier of transport than the bulk of his lairdship's income."
He turned to direct a piercing look over his shoulder at the two large mule-drawn wagons that accompanied the party.
"Bags of grain and bunches of turnips have at least the benefit of lack of motion. Fowl, if suitably trussed and caged, I have nae argument with. Nor with goats, though they prove some inconvenience in terms of their omnivorous habits. One ate a handkerchief of mine last year, though I admit the fault was mine in allowing the fabric to protrude injudiciously from my coat pocket."
The thin lips set in a determined line.
"I have given explicit directions this year, though. We shall not accept live pigs."
The necessity of protecting Mr. Gowan's saddlebags and the two wagons explained the presence of the 20 or so men who made up the rest of the rent-collecting party, I supposed. All were armed and mounted, and there were a number of pack animals bearing what I assumed were supplies for the sustenance of the party. Mrs. Fitz, among her farewells and exhortations, had told me that accommodations would be primitive or non-existent, with many nights spent encamped along the road. I was quite curious to know what had led a man of Mr. Gowan's obvious qualifications to take up a post in the remote Scottish Highlands, far from the amenities of civilised life to which he must be accustomed.
"Well, as to that," he said in answer to my questions, "as a young man, I had a small practice in Edinburgh, with lace curtains in the window and a shiny brass plate by the door with my name inscribed upon it. But I grew rather tired of making wills and drawing up conveyances and seeing the same faces in the street day after day. So I left," he said simply.
He had purchased a horse and some supplies and set off with no idea where he was going or what to do once he got there.
"You see, I must confess," he said,
dabbing his nose primly with a monogrammed handkerchief,
"to something of a taste for adventure. However, neither my stature nor my family background had fitted me for the life of highwayman or seafarer, which were the most adventurous occupations I could envision at the time. As an alternative, I determined that my best path lay upward into the Highlands. I thought that in time I might perhaps induce some clan chieftain to, well, to allow me to serve him in some way."
And in the course of his travels he had, in fact, encountered such a chieftain.
"Jacob Mackenzie," he said, with a fond reminiscent smile, "and a wicked red old rascal he was."
Mr. Gowan nodded toward the front of the line, where Jamie McTavish's bright hair blazed in the mist.
"His grandson's very like him, you ken. We met first at the point of a pistol, Jacob and I, as he was robbing me. I yielded my horse and my bags with a good grace, having little other choice. But I believe he was a bit taken aback when I insisted upon accompanying him on foot, if necessary."
"Jacob Mackenzie? That would be Colum and Dougal's father?" I asked. The elderly lawyer nodded.
"Aye. Of course, he was not laird then. That happened a few years later, with a very small bit of assistance from me," he added modestly. "Things were less civilised then,"
he said nostalgically.
"Oh, were they?"
I said politely. "And Colum,
inherited you, so to speak. Something of the kind, Mr. Gowan said. There was a wee bit of confusion when Jacob died, you see. Colum was heir to Leoch, to be sure, but he...
The lawyer paused, looking ahead and behind to see that no one was close enough to listen. The man-at-arms had ridden forward, though, to catch up with some of his mates, and a good four lengths separated us from the wagon-driver behind.
Colum was a hallman to the age of 18 or so, he resumed his story, and gave promise to be a fine leader. He took Letitia to wife as part of an alliance with the Camerons. I drew up the marriage contract, he added as a footnote, but soon after the marriage he had a bad fall during a raid, broke the long bone of his thigh, and it mended poorly.
I nodded.
It would have, of course.
And then, Mr. Gowan went on with a sigh,
he rose from his bed too soon and took a tumble down the stairs that broke the other leg. He lay in his bed close on a year, but it soon became clear that the damage was permanent. And that was when Jacob died, unfortunately.
The little man paused to marshal his thoughts. He glanced ahead again, as though looking for someone. Failing to find them, he settled back into the saddle.
That was about the time there was all the fuss about his sister's marriage, too, he said. And Dougal... Well, I'm afraid Dougal did not acquit himself so very well over that affair. Otherwise, do you see, Dougal might have been made chief at the time. But 'twas felt he'd not the judgment for it yet.
He shook his head.
Oh, there was a great stramash about it all. There were cousins and uncles and taxmen and a great gathering to decide the matter.
But they did choose Colum after all, I said. I marvelled once again at the force of personality of Colum Mackenzie. And casting an eye at the withered little man who rode at my side, I rather thought Colum had also had some luck in choosing his allies.
They did, but only because the brothers stood firm together. There was nae doubt, you see, of Colum's courage, nor yet of his mind, but only of his body. 'Twas clear he'd never be able to lead his men into battle again. But there was Dougal, sound and whole, if a bit reckless and hot-headed. And he stood behind his brother's chair and vowed to follow Colum's word and be his legs and his sword-arm in the field. So a suggestion was made that Colum be allowed to become laird, as he should in the ordinary way, and Dougal be made war-chieftain to lead the clan in time of battle. It was a situation not without precedent, he added primly.
The modesty with which he had said, a suggestion was made, made it clear just whose suggestion it had been.
And whose man are you? I asked. Colum's or Dougal's? My interests must lie with the Mackenzie clan as a whole, Mr. Gowan said circumspectly. But as a matter of form, I have sworn my oath to Colum. A matter of form, my foot, I thought. I had seen that oath-taking, though I didn't recall the small form of the lawyer specifically among so many men. No man could have been present at that ceremony and remain unmoved, not even a born solicitor. And the little man on the bay mare, dry as his bones might be, and steeped to the marrow in the law, had by his own testimony the soul of a romantic.
"He must find you a great help," I said diplomatically.
"Oh, I do a bit from time to time," he said, "in a small way, as I do for others." "Should you find yourself in need of advice, my dear," he said, beaming genially, "do feel free to call upon me. My discretion may be relied upon, I do assure you."
He bowed quaintly from his saddle. "To the same extent as your loyalty to Colum Mackenzie," I said, arching my brows. The small brown eyes met mine full on, and I saw both the cleverness and the humour that lurked in their faded depths.
"A wheel," he said, without apology. "Worth a try."
"I suppose so," I said, more amused than angered. "But I assure you, Mr. Gowan, that I have no need of your discretion, at least at present." "It's catching," I thought, hearing myself. "I sound just like him." "I am an English lady," I added firmly, "and nothing more. Colum is wasting his time and yours in trying to extract secrets from me that don't exist."
or that do exist, but are untellable, I thought. Mr. Gowan's discretion might be limitless, but not his belief.
"He didn't send you along just to coerce me into damaging revelations, did he?" I demanded, suddenly struck by the thought. "Oh, no." Mr. Gowan gave a short laugh at the idea. "No, indeed, my dear. I fulfil an essential function in managing the records and receipts for Dougal, and performing such small legal requirements that the clansmen in the more distant areas may have. And I'm afraid that even at my advanced age, I have not entirely outgrown the urge to seek adventure. Things are much more settled now than they used to be."
He heaved a sigh that might have been one of regret.
"But there is always the possibility of robbery along the road or attack near the borders."
He patted the second bag on his saddle. "This bag is not entirely empty, you ken."
He turned back the flap long enough for me to see the gleaming grips of a pair of scroll-handled pistols, snugly set in twin loops that kept them within easy reach. He surveyed me with a glance that took in every detail of my costume and appearance.
"You should really be armed yourself, my dear," he said in a tone of mild reproof, "though I suppose Dougal thought it would not be suitable. Still, I'll speak to him about it," he promised.
We passed the rest of the day in pleasant conversation, wandering among his reminiscences of the dear departed days when men were men and the pernicious weed of civilization was less rampant upon the bonny wild face of the Highlands. At nightfall, we made camp in a clearing beside the road. I had a blanket, rolled and tied behind my saddle, and with this I prepared to spend my first night of freedom from the castle. As I left the fire and made my way to a spot behind the trees, though, I was conscious of the glances that followed me. Even in the open air, it seemed, freedom had definite limits. We reached the first stopping place near noon of the second day. It was no more than a cluster of three or four huts set off the road at the foot of a small glen. A stool was brought out from one of the cottages for Dougal's use, and a plank, thoughtfully brought along in one of the wagons, laid across two others to serve as a writing surface for Mr. Gowan. He withdrew an enormous square of starched linen from the tail pocket of his coat and laid it neatly over a stump, temporarily withdrawn from its usual function as a chopping block. He seated himself upon this and began to lay out inkhorn, ledgers, and receipt books, as composed in his manner as though he were still behind his lace curtains in Edinburgh. One by one, the men from the nearby crofts appeared to conduct their annual business with the laird's representative. This was a leisurely affair, and conducted with a good deal less formality than the goings-on in the hall of Castle Leoch. Each man came, fresh from field or shed, and drawing up a vacant stool, sat alongside Dougal in apparent equality, explaining, complaining, or merely chatting. Some were accompanied by a sturdy son or two, bearing bags of grain or wool. At the conclusion of each conversation, the indefatigable Ned Gowan would write out a receipt for the payment of the year's rent, record the transaction neatly in his ledger, and flick a finger to one of the drovers who would obligingly heave the payment onto a wagon. Less frequently, a small heap of coins would disappear into the depths of his leather bag with a faint chinking sound. Meanwhile, the men-at-arms lounged beneath the trees or disappeared up the wooded bank. To hunt, I supposed. Variations of this scene were repeated over the next few days. Now and then I would be invited into a cottage for cider or milk, and all of the women would crowd into the small single room to talk with me. Sometimes a cluster of rude huts would be large enough to support a tavern or even an inn, which became Dougal's headquarters for the day. Once in a while, the rents would include a horse, a sheep, or other livestock. These were generally traded to someone in the neighbourhood for something more portable, or, if Jamie declared a horse fit for inclusion in the castle stables, it would be added to our string. I wondered about Jamie's presence in the party. While the young man clearly knew horses well, so did most of the men in the party, including Dougal himself.
Considering also that horses were both a rare sort of payment and usually nothing special in the way of breeding, I wondered why it had been thought necessary to bring an expert along. It was a week after we had set out, in a village with an unpronounceable name, that I found out the real reason why Dougal had wanted Jamie. The village, though small, was large enough to boast a tavern with two or three tables and several rickety stools. Here Dougal held his hearings and collected his rents. And after a rather indigestible luncheon of salt beef and turnips, he held court, buying ale for the tenants and cotters who had lingered after their transactions, and a few villagers who drifted in when their daily work was completed to gawk at the strangers and hear such news as we carried. I sat quietly on a settle in the corner, sipping sour ale and enjoying the respite from horseback. I was paying little attention to Dougal's talk, which shifted back and forth between Gaelic and English, ranging from bits of gossip and farming talk to what sounded like vulgar jokes and meandering stories. I was wondering idly how long at this rate it might take to reach Fort William, and once there, exactly how I might best part company with the Scots of Castle Leoch without becoming equally entangled with the English army garrison. Lost in my own thoughts, I hadn't noticed that Dougal had been speaking for some time alone, as though making a speech of some kind. His hearers were following him intently with occasional brief interjections and exclamations. Coming gradually back to an awareness of my surroundings, I realized that he was skillfully rousing his audience to a high pitch of excitement about something. I glanced around. Fat Rupert and the little lawyer Ned Gowan sat against the wall behind Dougal, tankards of ale forgotten on the bench beside them as they listened intently. Jamie, frowning into his own tankard, leaned forward with his elbows on the table. Whatever Dougal was saying, he didn't seem to care for it. With no warning, Dougal stood, seized Jamie's collar, and pulled. Old and shabbily made to begin with, the shirt tore cleanly down the seams. Taken completely by surprise, Jamie froze. His eyes narrowed, and I saw his jaws set tightly, but he didn't move as Dougal spread aside the ripped flaps of cloth to display his back to the onlookers. There was a general gasp at the sight of the scarred back, then a buzz of excited indignation. I opened my mouth, then caught the word Sassenach, spoken with no kindly intonation, and shut it again. Jamie, with a face like stone, stood and stepped back from the small crowd clustering around him. He carefully peeled off the remnants of his shirt, wadding the cloth into a ball. An elderly little woman who reached the level of his elbow was shaking her head and patting his back gingerly, making what I assumed were comforting remarks in Gaelic. If so, they were clearly not having the hoped-for effect. He replied tersely to a few questions from the men present. The two or three young girls who had come in to fetch their family's dinner ale were clustered together against the far wall, whispering intently to each other, with frequent big-eyed glances across the room. With a look at Dougal that should by rights have turned the older man to stone, Jamie tossed the ruins of his shirt into a corner of the hearth and left the room in three long strides, shaking off the sympathetic murmurs of the crowd. Deprived of spectacle, their attentions turned back to Dougal. I didn't understand most of the comment, though the bits I caught seemed to be highly anti-English in nature. I was torn between wanting to follow Jamie outside and staying inconspicuously where I was. I doubted that he wanted any company, though, so I shrank back into my corner and kept my head down, studying my blurry, pale reflection in the surface of my tankard. The clink of metal made me look up. One of the men, a sturdy-looking crofter in leather trews, had tossed a few coins on the table in front of Dougal, and seemed to be making a short speech of his own. He stood back, thumbs braced in his belt, as though daring the rest to something. After an uncertain pause, one or two bold souls followed suit, and then a few more, digging copper doits and pence out of purse and sporran. Dougal thanked them heartily, waving a hand at the landlord for another round of ale. I noticed that the lawyer, Ned Gowan, was tidily stowing the new contributions in a separate pouch from that used for the Mackenzie rents bound for Colum's coffers, and I realised what the purpose of Dougal's little performance must be. Rebellions, like most other business propositions, require capital. The raising and provisioning of an army takes gold, as does the maintenance of its leaders. And from the little I remembered of Bonnie Prince Charlie, the young pretender to the throne, part of his support had come from France, but part of the finances behind his unsuccessful rising had come from the shallow, threadbare pockets of the people he proposed to rule. So Colum, or Dougal, or both, were Jacobites, supporters of the young pretender against the lawful occupant of the throne of England, George II. Finally, the last of the cotters and tenants drifted away to their dinners, and Dougal stood up and stretched, looking moderately satisfied, like a cat that has dined at least on milk, if not cream. He weighed the smaller pouch and tossed it back to Ned Gowan for safekeeping.
"Aye, well enough," he remarked. "Can I expect a great deal from such a small place? But manage enough of the same, and it will be a respectable sum."
"Respectable is not quite the word I'd use," I said, rising stiffly from my lurking place. Dougal turned, as though noticing me for the first time.
"No,"
he said, mouth curling in amusement.
"Why not? Have you an objection to loyal subjects contributing their mite in support of their sovereign?"
"None," I said, meeting his stare. "No matter which sovereign it is. It's your collection methods I don't care for." Dougal studied me carefully, as though my features might tell him something.
"No matter which sovereign it is," he repeated softly. "I thought she had no Gaelic."
"I haven't," I said shortly. "But I've the sense I was born with, and 2 ears in good working order. And whatever King George's health may be in Gaelic, I doubt very much that it sounds like Bra Stuart." He tossed back his head and laughed.
"That it, doesn't he agreed. "And I'd tell you the proper Gaelic for your liege lord and ruler, but it isn't a word suitable for the lips of a lady, Sassenach or no."
Stooping, he plucked the balled-up shirt out of the ashes of the hearth and shook the worst of the soot off it.
"Since you dinna care for my methods, perhaps you'd wish to remedy them," he suggested, thrusting the ruined shirt into my hands. "Get a needle from the lady of the house and mend it."
"Mend it yourself." I shoved it back into his arms and turned to leave.
"Suit yourself," Dougal said pleasantly from behind me. "Jimmy can mend his own shirt then, if you're not disposed to help."
I stopped, then turned reluctantly, hand out. "All right," I began, but was interrupted by a large hand that snaked over my shoulder and snatched the shirt from Dougal's grasp. Dividing an opaque glance evenly between us, Jamie tucked the shirt under his arm and left the room as silently as he had entered it. We found accommodation for the night at a crofter's cottage. Or I should say I did. The men slept outside, disposed in various haystacks, wagon beds, and patches of bracken. In deference to my sex, or my status as semi-captive, I was provided with a pallet on the floor inside, near the hearth. While my pallet seemed vastly preferable to the single bedstead in which the entire family of 6 were sleeping, I rather envied the men their open-air sleeping arrangements. The fire wasn't put out, only damped for the night, and the air in the cottage was stifling with warmth, and the scents and sounds of the tossing, turning, groaning, snoring, sweating, farting inhabitants. After some time I gave up any thought of sleeping in that smothered atmosphere. I rose and strolled quietly outside, taking a blanket with me. The air outside was so fresh by contrast with the congestion in the cottage that I leaned against the stone wall, gulping in enormous lungfuls of the delicious cool stuff. There was a guard sitting in quiet watchfulness under a tree by the path, but he merely glanced at me. Apparently, deciding I wasn't going far in my shift, he went back to whittling at a small object in his hands. The moon was bright, and the blade of the tiny skiandu flickered in the leafy shadows. I walked around the cottage and a little way up the hill behind it, careful to watch for slumbering forms in the grass. I found a pleasant private spot between two large boulders.